From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Inflation is running at a 30-year high. And at last check, Americans' wages are not keeping up with their price tags. Now, the head of the Federal Reserve has been saying it's transitory, this will pass. But one high-profile economist has been warning of persistent inflation for months, and that is Larry Summers. Here he is back in February on Bloomberg.
We're going to set ourselves up for inflation concerns, and then we're either going to have inflation or we're going to have a collision between fiscal and monetary policy to contain inflation of a kind that doesn't usually end well.
And Larry Summers joins us now. He was Treasury Secretary under President Clinton and is now President Emeritus of Harvard University. Welcome back.
Good to be back with you.
Now, we see prices up almost everywhere. Housing, cars, gasoline, and consumers' expectations of prices going up. Where, in your mind, is the most important evidence of persistent inflation?
Almost everything you look at is sending an inflationary sign. I think it's important to look at the data, but it's also important to look at lived experience. If you talk to businesses, they all say that they're facing rising prices, and they're also all confident that they're going to be able to pass the rising prices on. So I think it's showing all the signs of a situation like the 1960s or the 1970s when inflation accelerated quite substantially.
Now, let's talk about your thoughts on why. The piece of tape we played of you back in February is when you were talking about the stimulus bill passed in the spring. It was a huge infusion of money into people's pockets. By one measure, it was six times as big as the 2009 stimulus during the Great Recession. At the time, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, said it's better to go too big than to go too small. At the time, was that a reasonable argument, better to go big?
At the time, I thought it was a mistake because it was likely to set up the kind of very difficult dilemmas we have today, where you either have to live with high and rising inflation and lose credibility, or you have to take actions to bring it under control that often, like stopping a car on ice, can create a very bad skid. That combined with the Fed's decision to be buying bonds to drive down interest rates, including to drive down mortgages in the face of an epic housing boom, created the difficulties we're having now.
Let me play you a piece of sound from Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, from Sunday. She said that all this hyper demand from consumers that's pushing up prices will come back when the pandemic eases. Let's take a listen.
When the economy recovers enough from COVID that demand patterns, people go back to eating out, traveling more, spending more on services, and the demand for products, for goods, begins to go back to normal.
Now, Larry Summers, we have a lot more tools, as you know, to manage COVID vaccines and treatment medicines. If we control the pandemic, manage it, do we control inflation?
I don't think so. I don't really understand what the argument is that when we start having more demand for lodging, more demand for tourism, somehow the sense of labor shortage is going to go away. I think when there are more people working and more people spending and normalization and more rapid growth, that could be as likely to exacerbate labor shortage. That could be as likely to put more pressure on housing markets as it is to reduce it.
What about Congress and the question of inflation? The president has a nearly $2 trillion social spending bill he's trying to get through Congress. Senator Joe Manchin, a key swing vote, worries that this will juice inflation, although other Democrats say it could actually fight inflation by lowering the cost of childcare, lowering the cost of prescription drugs. Is this the wrong time for that bill?
No, I think it's the right time for that bill, but I think both sides in the argument you cited are wrong. It's not reasonable to suggest that this is going to reduce the inflation rate, but the spending is less over 10 years than the 2021 spending was over 1 year, and it's going to be paid for with revenue increases. So I also don't think it's right to worry that it'll accelerate inflation. I think we need to do more about climate change and more about helping working families. So I've been a supporter of the bill. But I do think we have to be very careful to make sure that it is basically paid for.
Finally, Larry Summers, what happens to the regular family if inflation gets out of control? Their buying power goes down, or potentially a deep recession? What?
I think their buying power goes down. It's harder to fill the tank. It's harder at the grocery store. And then the likelihood is, since that can't go on forever, their floating rate mortgage floats way up, and the economy is braked hard. And that means that they've got to worry a lot more about holding on to their job. You know, the best way to get to your destination fast is not to speed, because then you're more likely to have an accident or you're more likely to get stopped. That basic idea is, I think, what policy has lost sight of. We all have the same objective: to grow the economy, to create as much employment as possible. But if you try to hit the accelerator too hard, you ultimately get where you're going less rapidly than you wanted to.
Larry Summers, economist, president emeritus at Harvard University. Thanks once again for your time, sir.
Thanks.
Students at Howard University in Washington, D.C. are packing up their so-called tent city. They occupied a central yard on campus for weeks, sleeping on air mattresses and in tents to protest what they said were unhealthy conditions in dormitories. On Monday, Howard President Wayne Frederick announced the administration has reached an agreement with the students.
I am pleased to share with you today that through ongoing dialogue and a desire to hear and address their concerns, the student protesters have agreed to end the Blackburn occupation and leave the building.
And for more, we're joined by WAMU's Dominique Maria Bonessi. Welcome, and remind us why the students were protesting in the first place.
Hi, Callum. Thanks so much. And yeah, so the students began their protests. You know, there has been concerns about the school's COVID testing policy, mold in dormitories, unclean air ducts. One mother told WAMU's reporter Dee Dwyer that her son was hospitalized and diagnosed with a respiratory illness because of unclean air and in his dorm room. And there were also other concerns about, you know, wanting transparency from the school administration and a town hall meeting with President Wayne Frederick that you just heard there. And then they also were demanding the reinstatement of student, faculty, and alumni members on the university's board of trustees.
I see. So, you know, if the air is bad in the dorm, sleeping outside in tents in early October sounds kind of refreshing, but now it's getting kind of cold, Dominique. So why did it take so long for them to reach an agreement with the administration?
Yeah, this is one of the longest protests in the school's history. It was 33 days long. On Monday, they finally announced that their protest was over. And, you know, they said they took 20 days to negotiate. Initially, when this protest first started, the university condemned them and said that they were, you know, not necessary in causing food service workers at the Blackburn University Center to lose their job. That's one of the main cafeteria hubs on campus. So, yeah, there was a lot of sort of backlash from the university when this protest first started.
And do we know what's in the deal? I mean, what are students telling you?
Right. Well, this agreement is actually confidential. There hasn't been any information released from the students or the university administration about the agreement. But WAMU asked one of the student organizers, Mason Calhoun, he's a freshman, if the demands were met. And Calhoun said all of them were met except for one about the reinstatement to the Board of Trustees, because there's litigation that's ongoing that's sort of out of the students' control.
You know, if we step back, I mean, we know that there's a long history of underfunding HBCUs. Is that really what was going on here? I mean, the university just didn't have the resources to maintain the dorms?
You know, that still is unclear, but, you know, yes, there is a history of underfunded HBCUs. Students say that, you know, the dorms aren't clean, the housing policy, that the school, they were alleging that the school lacks a housing policy. You know, these are concerns that we're not just hearing at Howard University. We're hearing them at universities throughout the country, and there is an underfunding of schools. You know, more recently in Maryland this year, they finally settled a $577 million lawsuit that took 15 years to settle to get Maryland's four HBCUs the funding that they, you know, that they deserved, because they for years a judge ruled that they had been maintaining a dual and segregated education system.
I see. So it's not just about Howard then, and that's one of the very top HBCUs. What about other campuses across the country? Are students taking note of what's going on at Harvard?
Yeah, I mean, so students in Georgia from Clark Atlanta, Morehouse, Morris Brown, and Spelman also began protesting in solidarity with Howard. They had similar demands, like they wanted a full assessment of housing needs and quality of life for students. And you know, they wanted senators to address the $45 billion investment in HBCUs and other minority institutions through Biden's infrastructure bill. And Clark Atlanta and Spelman are working on their negotiations and demands now.
That's Dominique Maria Bonessi, reporter for WAMU. Thanks, Dominique.
Thanks.
Fossil fuel projects for oil fields or coal mining sites have brought land use conflicts for generations, often displacing people from their lands. That's one reason many are calling for renewable energy. And it's true that renewable energy brings benefits that are fairly obvious, a whole lot of kilowatts without the carbon pollution. Thing is, wind and solar energy farms require even more land than fossil fuel projects, bringing disputes to those places too. In fact, a new report finds a troubling pattern of human rights abuses in renewable energy and says it should set off alarm bells. That group is the Business and Human Rights Resource Center, and the program manager there is Jesse Cato, who joins us from Berlin. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So just to understand this, can you give me an example of a human rights abuse that you found is really part of a pattern in green energy?
Yeah. So, I mean, we at the Resource Center track allegations across all sectors. What we've seen over the last 10 years, though, is a growth in the allegations that we're seeing coming from renewable energy. Mm. And as you mentioned, those are occurring because wind and solar projects have a significant land footprint. And so that is resulting in a number of allegations coming in related to land rights and land violations, forced displacement. So Mexico is still, you know, a significant producer of fossil fuels. It still gets most of its energy from fossil fuels. It is trying to diversify, and it has quite a lot of land that is open and useful for wind projects. But those lands are primarily indigenous lands, and in Oaxaca, we've seen a significant amount of not just allegations of abuse, but really severe forms of, you know, conflict within communities. In 2018, there were 15 deaths that were related to one of the wind farms wanting to come in there, and discontent between different community members not having that social license to operate within the community.
So you're describing something happening in Mexico, but your report references Chile, Ethiopia, Kenya, Morocco, Scotland, Taiwan, the killings of indigenous activists against a hydropower plant in Guatemala. And so this is in a lot of places. And you give companies in general an overall score of 28 out of 100. I mean, that's not a very good score. What are the systemic problems you're seeing?
As I said, we specifically do see this, you know, the sharp end of this within indigenous communities. When we look at those companies, so within our benchmark, you know, we don't see any company policies around explicitly respecting land rights. We don't see explicit commitments to identify legitimate tenure rights holders. And this is, you know, sort of despite the fact that indigenous rights often intersect with those land rights. And just under one quarter of the companies we looked at had policies explicitly recognizing and respecting the rights of indigenous peoples. No company as well had any explicit policy that committed itself to non-retaliation against human rights and environmental defenders. And this is another growing area of concern within the resource sector.
And your team is finding retaliation happening?
Yeah, so in 2020, we recorded attacks against environmental and human rights defenders in the renewable energy sector. We recorded 30. We're also within our database of attacks. Indigenous peoples make up 40% of those attacks, even though they only make up 5%. Of the global population.
Yeah, wow. Well, Jesse, you use this term social license to operate, and I've heard that term a lot from fossil fuel companies, right? Oil drillers that need land, coal mining companies that need land, and they say they need buy-in from the local communities otherwise they're in trouble. Are renewable energy companies doing any better than their fossil fuel peers on this question?
Not yet, but they certainly can. You know, I think the renewable energy sector is at a critical point in setting the tone for what the energy transition can look like. And it's, you know, there are two paths, and if it's going to replicate this profit-driven extractive model, which has caused significant harm, or is it going to be, you know, a new path for the energy sector, which has human rights at the center of it? But that window, you know, of opportunity is rapidly closing. Like any growing sector, there is only a small time to influence how it's going to operate going forward. And if we don't push for the renewable energy sector to sort of consider this and be on top of the human rights risks, we are going to accept a transition that is fast but is not fair, and it is absolutely going to replicate the abuses we've seen from the extractive sector.
Coal has been around for centuries, oil about a century and a half. Fossil fuel companies, today they have dedicated enemies, right, who wake up every day to stop them. If wind and solar companies aren't careful, could they be creating their own enemies?
Absolutely. I mean, I think anything where people are disenfranchised, where their voices are not heard, and where projects are going forward, you know, without legitimate consultation, there is a significant risk of, you know, not just reputational risk, but risk to the energy transition as a whole. And I think that's one of the differences and challenges that the renewable energy sector has to face. You know, we don't really have a choice about whether we transition or not. We know that is an imperative. What we do have a choice about is how we do that. And the sustainability of the sector is going to rely on companies thinking about new ways of operating, looking at co-ownership and co-benefit models, looking at different forms of consultation and saying, this is the way we're going forward.
That's Jesse Cato of the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. Jesse, thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
When environmentalists called for the end of gas-powered cars, they used to get laughed at. Life without tailpipes was seen as a pipe dream. See what I did there. But now the prospect of phasing out gas cars is being taken very seriously. NPR's Camila Domonoske takes a look at just how quickly the idea has gone mainstream.
The advocacy group Cultura wants America to stop using gasoline. And just a few years ago, its main tools in that fight were things like breakup-themed music videos. We had a good run, but now we're done. And performance art.
We did what's called the Ghosts of Gasoline, actors that were dressed up in their white bodysuits with hoses and nozzles.
Matthew Metz is the co-executive director of Cultura, and he says art like this got people talking. But when Cultura tried to propose actual laws to end the sale of gas cars, people laughed. They're not laughing anymore. Cultura helps write legislation now. Tesla is the world's most valuable automaker. Ford is making an electric F-150. And General Motors plans to go entirely electric. And around the world?
Iceland, United Kingdom, Sweden, Norway.
Sandra Vapelhorst is with the International Council on Clean Transportation. They've been tracking which governments have set dates for ending the sale of new gas cars. And yes, she's still going.
Canada and two provinces, British Columbia and Quebec.
The big climate talks that just ended last week included a call to phase out gas-powered cars worldwide by 2040. The European Union might mandate that change by 2035. In the U.S., the federal government wants to reduce the number of gas vehicles, but hasn't embraced a total phase-out. Some states have, though. California, Massachusetts, and New York all plan to end gas car sales within 15 years. And those state orders and laws haven't even been that controversial. Trina Saha lives in Queens, and she doesn't know anyone who got up in arms about New York's new law.
Yeah, I think more people in New York were mad about soda limitations than they'd be about like gas-powered vehicles.
Today, Saha fills her Toyota Corolla with gas. But she says a car's features are more important than how it's powered.
I mean, if it gets you from A to B.
And figures she'll probably get an electric vehicle eventually, no big deal. But the key word there might be eventually. A gas car phase out by 2030 or 2035 might still feel far away to most people, which could explain the lack of backlash. And it could also be a problem. Jasmine Sanders is with the group Our Climate. She says if states actually want to hit these targets, changes to industry and infrastructure need to happen immediately.
We have to go ahead and start doing this now. We cannot wait until 2034 and then telling people, no, you can't buy that gas vehicle.
And those changes are hard. Gas and diesel vehicles make up 97% of new car sales. Electric vehicles are a tiny, expensive slice of the market. If they explode in popularity, we'll need a ton more chargers and transmission lines, not to mention changes to factories and consumer behavior. In short, America has not broken up with gasoline yet, and it's got a long way to go. But the idea that the age of gas cars is ending, it's not a fringe proposal anymore. It's under serious consideration in the halls of power. In fact, that anti-gasoline music video a few years back, it featured a cameo from a woman with a blonde bob enthusiastically lip-syncing along about the urgent need to give up gasoline. That was Jennifer Granholm, better known today as the Secretary of Energy. Gasoline, gasoline. Camila Domonoske, NPR News. We gotta leave you in the ground.
I'm out of the door with my foot to the floor. Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
This week, the FDA is expected to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID booster shots for all adults. That means 10 million more people will be eligible. Right now, federal guidelines recommend boosters only for people who are over 65 or immunocompromised or at high risk of exposure. Still, at least 7 states already endorse boosters for all adults. So yeah, mixed messages. To help us figure this all out, let's talk again to Lena Wen. She's an ER doctor and professor at George Washington University's School of Public Health. And Dr. Wen, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to join you.
So let's just start with everyone's most pressing question. If I'm an adult under 65, no pre-existing conditions, should I get a booster shot?
If you're even asking the question, the answer is yes. And here's why. We know that immunity with the vaccines do wane over time. And we know that the immunity is actually beginning to wane not only against symptomatic infection, but also severe infection. We have seen also, based on data in Israel and here in the US, that a third dose is extremely protective. It restores that initial level of high protection. And so I guess the question is, why wouldn't we want to do this, especially as cases are rising around the country? Again, why would we not want to give ourselves the best chance for having protection coming into this winter? It's better for individual health, and it's also better mm-hmm. for public's health in reducing the level of COVID-19 spread too.
Now, let me ask you about the public messaging going out to all of us. I have a pre-existing condition and I got a booster, but my drugstore never asked me about that. So it seems they're just giving it out. There's a big gap between the messaging from the government and the reality out here, isn't there?
That's exactly right. And I actually think that that's the biggest thing that the FDA and CDC can be doing this week, which is to clarify that boosters are not just something that's a nice to have, that should be an option. But at this point, it is something that is quite essential for individual health and for the public's health. It is true that there has been only self-attestation, which I agree with, that people who want a booster should be able to get one. But as a result, we have huge equity issues, that people who know that they can skirt skirt the rules, have been able to get a booster, versus other people who are more vulnerable actually haven't even known that they are eligible to get the booster. And so sending out the message that everybody should be getting a booster at this point ahead of a possible winter surge, that will help everyone, but in particular will also help to reduce rampant disparities that we've already seen to be quite significant over the course of the pandemic.
Yeah, a winter surge. We still have big pockets of unvaccinated people in the country. So are boosters going to be enough to turn around the surge that might be coming?
I don't think that boosters alone will be sufficient. I also think that we need to employ other tools, including rapid tests, before people gather over the holidays, over Thanksgiving coming up, for example. It should be the norm that everybody getting together indoors gets a rapid test that helps to weed out those who may not know that they have COVID. Also, there are many jurisdictions, including here in Washington, D.C., that are removing mask mandates indoors. And I really think this is the wrong time to be doing that. We should be employing all of our tools. We should be looking at what's going on in Europe and the case surges that are happening there. Everybody should get a booster before the holidays if they are at least 6 months out.
Dr. Lena Nguyen teaches public health at George Washington University. Thanks, Dr. Nguyen, as always.
Harvard University is fighting a legal battle over pre-Civil War photographs of enslaved people. The photos are in the collection of Harvard's Peabody Museum, but a woman named Tamara Lanier says the two people in the photos are her ancestors. Her lawsuit against Harvard, alleging wrongful seizure and possession of the photos, brings up complicated questions of ownership. Let's bring in Max Larkin. He's been covering this for member station WBUR here in Boston. Max, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Max, can you start with just explaining the story behind these photos? What are they, and why were they taken in the first place?
Yeah, these four images are daguerreotypes, like old early photographs, and they show a black man identified as Congo Renti and his daughter Delia. They're both stripped to the waist, and each is photographed once straight on and once in profile. And they're part of a series of daguerreotype portraits of seven enslaved people, all taken at the request of Louis Agassiz, who was a Harvard professor and a prominent naturalist. And just as Agassiz had classified fish and rocks, Agassiz was here trying to classify people. He wanted to prove a hunch that black and white people didn't share a common ancestor and that black people were in some ways intrinsically inferior to white people. So these are records of that really distasteful project, and they involved, in short, taking or abducting these people off of the plantation where they lived and posing them largely unclothed at a Columbia, South Carolina photo studio.
It's such a painful history, and we know that part of that includes erasing lineages. Family records are very hard to trace. So to that end, how do we know that Lanier is a descendant? She's been fighting to get these photos for more than a decade. What's her claim to them, and why does she want them?
Yeah, Lanier says she grew up hearing of an enslaved ancestor who was born in the Congo, known to her as Papa Renti, sort of part of her family lore. He was self-taught. He was a spiritual leader. He was a man who eventually was emancipated and lived on to vote. And as you said, Cal, American slavery did break down natural families as a habit, and so it can be really hard to establish hard genealogical ties. Lanier's attorneys say they're satisfied beyond doubt that Renti really was her great-great-great-grandfather, I think four greats. Harvard's experts are apparently a little less certain. But Lanier's claim is, in short, that the photographs depict a crime in progress against members of her family and that Harvard licenses and displays them and earns money for doing so, and that the way that they use them tends to show Renti as just a slave and not all the other things he was.
So Lanier, in this case, is represented by a prominent attorney, Benjamin Crump. Listeners may be familiar with him for representing Ahmaud Arbery's family, George Floyd's family. What is his argument in this case?
I think Crump's argument is that his more contemporary cases have deep ties to this case through the medium of the sort of underlying history of slavery. And he repeated that Renti and Delia are, in a sense, still enslaved by the way they're sort of trapped and used in Harvard's archive. So at those oral arguments, Crump said, these are not just harmless images.
Instead, we are discussing the culmination of a malicious and evil scientific experiment in an attempt to legitimize the abhorrent concept that persons of color are property.
And then, Cal, at the same time, Crump was trying pointedly to tie Agassiz to Harvard, the institution, today, saying that back then they were the historical enabler of that experiment, and they're still benefiting from it now.
I see. Meanwhile, though, Harvard says they do have a right to these pictures. It's their property, and they say just because Linear may be a descendant, that doesn't automatically grant her the right to own the photos. Legally speaking, how strong is that case?
Pretty strong. Harvard's president, Larry Bacow, made one comment on the record that has sort of ricocheted around in the conversation that he thinks the law is on the university's side here. So it's one thing for someone to argue that they didn't consent to a picture being taken. Maybe they're under 18 or the photograph violates their privacy. And there is lots of precedent for the state confiscating photographs that are themselves part of a criminal act against their subjects. But even then, that doesn't mean that the victims or their descendants get the images themselves. Harvard's lawyer Anton Mitlitsky pushed just that argument when he was pressed earlier this month by Justice Elspeth Cipher.
So why isn't this a fruit or an instrumentality of the crime?
I mean, first of all, there's absolutely no question that Renty and Delia were subject to crimes and worse than crimes. I think the question now is, what is the remedy for that and whether it's a judicial remedy based in property?
And Max, what are the broader legal implications? I mean, what does it mean for the world of media if Linear wins her case, the work of photojournalists, for example?
Well, Harvard came prepared to argue just that point. They had a supporting brief of their own that was drafted by the Massachusetts Newspaper Publishers Association and the New England First Amendment Coalition. Those two groups were clear about the painful context of these images, but they said the laws regarding image ownership work that way for a reason. Here's First Amendment Coalition Director Justin Silverman.
Imagine an editor sorting through photos of battlefields or mass gatherings. How would that editor even begin to sort out all the claims of ownership by those depicted in the images?
The result, Silverman says, would be a chilling effect in news and museums and publishing where vital photojournalism, you might think of leaked images from Abu Ghraib or photographs of crimes or massacres, aren't shared because they might prompt costly lawsuits from the people they depict.
So a lot of reasons to keep track of this case. We know you'll keep tabs on it for us, Max. That's Max Larkin, multimedia reporter for member station WBUR in Boston. Max, thanks for bringing us the story.
Thanks for having me.
To Houston now. Legal troubles are piling up for organizers of the Astroworld Music Festival. That's where 10 people died earlier this month. The musicians Travis Scott and Drake, along with Apple Music, are among those named in a $750 million lawsuit filed yesterday. It was brought by 125 people who were injured when the crowd surged to the stage. Meanwhile, this tragedy is prompting some young concertgoers to pause and reflect. YR Media's Nina Roll is one of them, and she sent us this essay.
I've been going to concerts and music festivals since before I could speak. When I was a baby, my mom would carry me on her back at reggae shows. And as I got older, I started saving up every dollar I had to go see my favorite singers perform. I've even camped out in front of venues all day long so I could get a spot at the very front of the stage. Many of my favorite memories involve standing in a crowd of thousands of people, singing along to songs I love with tears running down my face. Concerts have always been my happy place, but I'm not so sure anymore. On November 5th, tens of thousands of people attended Travis Scott's Astroworld Music Festival in Houston. All of them were excited to see artists they love, and none of them were expecting the night to end in such a tragedy. Before everything happened, I remember seeing the concert lineup. It sounded good, and I probably would have gone if it were closer to home. I've seen Travis Scott perform, and when the news of what happened at Astroworld broke, I was completely shattered. How could something that was supposed to bring joy turn into something so dark? I woke up Saturday after the festival to thousands of videos flooding my social feeds. After I finished scrolling, I immediately texted my younger brother saying, "You better be careful at Cardi next week." My brother was going to see Playboi Carti a few days later, and I couldn't help but think what happened at Astroworld could have easily happened to my brother, or even to me. My brother's a big guy, but still, I reminded him to not only be careful for himself, but also for those around him. The number one rule in mosh etiquette is if someone falls, you pick them back up. And even though I said all of these things to keep him and others safe, they're not the only ones responsible. Events like this need lots of organization, like enough security, medical supplies, and trained staff. Astroworld had none of that, and the events that unfolded were absolutely preventable. Concerts were once a place where I could forget all my worries and let go. And now I'm full of fear and anxiety. Standing in a crowd of thousands of people listening to music usually makes me excited, especially after being stuck inside for over a year. I've been eager to get out and be with other people. But after what happened at Astroworld, I can't confidently say that's how I feel anymore. For Here and Now, I'm Nina Roll.
And Nina Roll is a reporter with YR Media, a national network of journalists and artists. President Biden is in Detroit today, telling workers at a GM electric car plant that the trillion-dollar infrastructure bill he signed on Monday will get the U.S. off the sidelines of green energy. And out west, a good chunk of the money will upgrade critical water infrastructure in a region where climate change has led to shorter winters, warmer temperatures, and drier soil for two decades now. Reporter Alex Hager covers the Colorado River Basin and water in the west for KUNC in Colorado, and he joins us now. Hi, Alex.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So help us understand, what are the most important water system needs in your part of the country?
Well, right now, the need is to make sure that this area can survive with a shrinking water supply. The Colorado River supports 40 million people in the Southwest and more than $1 trillion of economic activity. So everything from kitchen sinks to produce growers all the way from Wyoming down to Mexico. And it's already straining to meet the needs of people and farms and businesses in the region. And climate change is shrinking the supply. And it's forcing everyone to get creative to make sure it can keep meeting those needs. Because water is pivotal to so many different aspects of life, the people in charge of water are having to get innovative, making sure that they can kind of stretch that shrinking supply a little bit further. And there's a lot that infrastructure money might be able to do to help in that. So everything from research and data gathering about how water is being used and where, to some of that more traditional infrastructure, like repairing aging dams and canals, and there's a whole lot of other stuff in between.
And there has been this two-decade-long drought in western states, which is just remarkable to think about for those of us far away. For the first time, the government declared a water shortage on the Colorado River, and now farmers in Arizona are going to see cuts in their water supplies. So help us understand, give us a picture of how bad and prolonged this drought is.
Well, right now, it's worse than it's ever been before. You know, levels in the nation's largest reservoirs are the lowest they've ever been. Basically, all of the indicators that scientists use to measure how dry things are, they're heading in the wrong direction. The air is warmer, it's snowing less, the soil is drying out, the amount of water in rivers and streams is dropping. And the main driver behind that is climate change caused by humans. We're getting deep enough into this drought that even a really snowy winter, a really rainy summer wouldn't be enough to turn things around. It would take back-to-back-to-back-to-back years of above-average conditions to escape drought, and lately, a lot of those have been coming in below average. So, you know, water supply in the West has always been finite, and this has been building for a long time. This shortage declaration was tripped by, reservoir levels dropping by a certain threshold, but really, this is the product of kind of a gradual and steady decrease in water supply.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In a practical sense, you know, there's more people moving to this region and less water. It's more people vying for a slice of the pie, and the pie itself is getting smaller.
No, I understand there's more than $8 billion set aside in this new law for water infrastructure in the West. You spoke to Alex Funk at the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. Let's take a listen.
There's a few items in there that specifically do call out the basin itself, but a lot of it is sort of west-wide or sort of even nationwide in scope. And so there's certainly, we're kind of entering that phase of, you know, sort of informing, hey, we'd love to kind of see more of this funding head to the Colorado River Basin to address some of these climate change issues that we're seeing.
So how is this money going to be divvied up? Who decides, and how will advocates like Alex Funk make their case for it?
Well, a lot of this is going to be distributed by federal agencies, so I'd expect to see the Bureau of Reclamation, the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management leading the way there. You know, I think the top line is that this infrastructure package is probably going to be applied to a lot of existing built infrastructure, where we might see the Build Back Better plan have a little bit more money for projects that are going to help prepare for some of those new challenges brought on by climate change. You know, old dams and canals, modernizing them with new technology. You're going to see money go towards programs focused on conservation and reuse. You hear that a lot out here in the Southwest. Basically, the idea that you're not going to get any more water than you're already given. So how do you stretch that allotment a little further? States are a big stakeholder here, you know, trying to get some money for their projects. But you also have to remember that some of this money is going to be going to people who barely have access to clean water at all. There's a lot of tribal communities within the basin. And in some of them, people can't reliably get clean water, or any water for that matter, to the taps in their homes. So there's some funding in this package to help address that too.
And finally, Alex, just on this prolonged drought, big cities, Denver, Phoenix, Albuquerque, they all depend on the Colorado River. The states in the region have come together on a pact to deal with this drought. But if it continues, what kind of conflict could be in store?
There's a lot of conflict. I think that it's really, you know, it's critical. If you just look at the number of people and the size of the economy that depends on getting this right, water issues bring in a lot of different groups into the fold. You know, of course, you've got the residents of seven states who don't want to see their taps run dry. You've got 30 federally recognized native tribes. You've got hydropower created by water running through dams, produce that's ending up in supermarkets around the country. So, you know, it can be easy to take water for granted in some other parts of the country, but in the Colorado River Basin, the way things are heading, that's not really an option anymore.
Alex Hager covers the Colorado River Basin and Western Water Rights at KUNC in Colorado. Alex, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Callum Borchers in Boston. This is Here and Now.